I'm Mike Springman. I'm an attorney, author, political commentator, and former diplomat. I had gone to Georgetown's University's Foreign Service School here in Washington, D.C., and had had Carol Quigley as a professor in a required course called The Development of Civilization. He used his own book, which I think was The Evolution of Civilization or Development of Civilizations.
That's a terrific topic. I mean, it's a great subject, isn't it? The idea of how we got where we are. But before we get into your course and Carol Quigley, can you tell us something about your career in the diplomatic service?
Sure. I had gone to Germany first, to Stuttgart, to the consul general there as an economic commercial officer. Had spent 3 years there. Went back to Washington and got reassigned to India, to New Delhi as commercial attaché, and was back in Washington again for a couple of years, and then was sent to Saudi Arabia as a reward for my service. And following Saudi Arabia, where I had been in charge of the visa section, where I ran into major difficulties with questionable applicants who I found out later were terrorists in training and recruited to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan as Mujahideen. Went to Stuttgart a second time for a couple of years as political economic officer. Was reassigned to Washington at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, which was a fascinating position because we had access to restricted diplomatic reporting and CIA reporting and National Security Agency reporting and wire services and newspapers. It was fascinating. And then they fired me.
Why did they fire you?
Well, they never told me. I took them to court at one point, and they sealed my Freedom of Information Act request as a threat to national security. But if you want my viewpoint, what they did was they didn't like me asking questions about who are these people I'm giving visas to. And I kept a list of people, copies of their applications, that the consul general in Jeddah, J. Philip Frayers, constantly insisted I overrule myself and give them visas. And they didn't want anybody to know what they were doing with recruiting the Mujahideen and other terrorists for Afghanistan. And I think later on, as I wrote in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rock the World, the program went on and on. They had found they had a cadre of people good at blowing things up and shooting things down and could be used to destabilize governments the United States didn't like, countries like Yugoslavia and Iraq and Libya and Syria.
Well, Mike, sounds to me like you may have been there right at the beginning of this, this operation. I think it was originally called Operation Cyclone. In Afghanistan, where the CIA was deliberately recruiting Islamic terrorists and actually turning them into mercenaries, effectively, and I suppose what we would now call Islamist, a kind of force, which then went on, you mentioned Yugoslavia, to the Bosnian Muslims, and then on to things like Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, ISIS, these kinds of organizations. That obviously is going to cause a bit of an upset if you're then going to your bosses and say, hey, what are you doing here?
Oh, exactly right. I was told to shut up and keep issuing visas. And I was there at the beginning of this Visas for Terrorists program and didn't see it for what it was until I was out of the State Department and talked to a journalist, Joe Trento, who put me wise to exactly what they were doing. And they figured that I was expendable if I didn't get with the program and not ask questions. I was fine if I questioned it, if I dared to wonder what the program really was, then there was something wrong with me and I was out the door.
So that was quite a while ago. But looking back on it now, what was the real big game plan? What was it that the Americans were, why were Americans giving these visas out to terrorists?
Well, they wanted to bring them to the United States for training, is mostly on the East Coast. Then they shipped them back to Afghanistan, and they armed them with Stinger missiles and all sorts of weaponry. And then when the Soviets finally withdrew from Afghanistan about, what was it, 1991, they said, oh, we've got this cadre. We've got it built up. What are we going to do with it? It seems such a shame to just let it go to waste and disband it. And certainly the Arab states didn't want these people to come home and practice their skills at overthrowing governments in their own countries.
Let's go back to your time at Georgetown University. Tell us how that fits into the U.S. university system.
Well, Georgetown kind of bills itself as a Catholic Harvard, although I think that might be a stretch. But it had the only undergraduate foreign service school in the country for decades. Father Edmund Walsh founded it sometime, I guess, in the 1920s, after he'd gone to the Versailles Peace Conference and seen that there were an awful lot of Americans there who didn't know the first thing about foreign affairs. And he thought to set up a school that would teach that exclusively. And I was told by a friend who would go into Georgetown with me that it was Walsh who hired Carol Quigley sometime in the early 1940s.
So Carol Quigley wrote this book, Tragedy and Hope. Was that in any way connected with the course that you were doing, or was it just the one on civilizations? Because that it would just tell us a bit about those two courses.
Sure. Well, the Development of Civilizations course was a required course for all first-year students in the Foreign Service School. And Quigley was a flamboyant showman in class and also a holy terror. He did things like demonstrating what it was like before they invented the horse collar, and he practiced gagging being a horse on stage with the reins around its neck, talked about how the Romans didn't have stirrups for the cavalry. That was imported later by the from Central Asia. He went into all kinds of detail about the Fertile Crescent and the development of civilization in that area, and he had a whole series of analytical points talking about the various stages that civilizations went through and how you could tell where a civilization was by what was happening. He defined democracy as a civilization where the citizens are allowed to possess firearms and you have a citizen soldier army rather than specialized weapons and only a certain select few, primary group of people that were essentially a professional army. Like in the Middle Ages, you had knights and their armor and their war horses, and they needed lots of money to buy this, and they needed people to dress them and to prepare them for battle. Whereas in the 19th century, the ordinary citizen could buy ordinary firearms that were as good as what the army was using, and it kept the government in check, according to Quigley. He went into great detail on how you were supposed to answer questions. He had, I don't know, three or four different types of questions, ways you were supposed to answer his questions. And if you used the wrong approach, you got marked down. So as a result, I and a good many of the people in the class, got C's and D's rather than A's and B's.
Are there any particular times of civilization, the development of civilization, that Quigley clearly relished and that, he was enjoying teaching about?
Well, he very much enjoyed the idea of British history, talking about the origin of the British Admiralty and the Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports. He talked about the Duke of Norfolk and how the British would change their positions and their nobility depending on what the situation demanded. For example, the Duke of Norfolk used to be, he taught, the hereditary Earl Marshal of England, who would arrange the feudal array when war was more of a pickup sport, where the king was going to declare war and his vassals were to contribute soldiers and their vassals were to contribute soldiers and so forth. And he said now it changed where the Earl Marshal, the Duke of Norfolk, doesn't do things like that anymore. He organizes pomp and pageantry and ceremonies and funerals and weddings and things like this. He seemed to relish the British way of doing things. And he would ask some interesting questions of the students. He would got up one day and said, "Okay, I have a table, two tables in front of me. On one table is $1 million in gold, and on the other table is a submachine gun. How many of you people would pick the table of gold?" And just about everybody raised their hand. And he said, "Well, no, you should pick the submachine guns off the table, because then you would have the machine gun and the gold."
Okay, so he was an American, wasn't he? Do you know what part of the United States he was from, how he got educated?
Yeah, he was a Bostonian. He was an Irish Catholic family man, and he'd gone to Harvard as an undergraduate, graduate, and then a PhD, and had taught at a couple of other schools before, I think Princeton was one of them, before Father Walsh recruited him to teach at Georgetown. His old man, according to one of my Massachusetts friends, had been fire chief of Boston.
Did you really look forward to the lessons, or did you find it all a bit too eccentric?
I very much enjoyed Development of Civilizations, the course and the book, which had virtually the same name. It really opened my eyes to the sweep of history. Kind of had a Toynbee approach to history, where you had changing civilizations and outside influences and the core center and the outer periphery. And he talked about Europe being the core and the Americas and North and South being kind of the periphery, along with maybe Eastern Europe that sort of thing, where he sort of traced how civilizations grew, what made them expand, what made them contract, what made them collapse. And it was generally outside influences. And his viewpoint was that Western civilization was inclusive and expansive and not the kind of civilization that was closed off. It was open to outside influences, and it spread around the world, beginning with the agricultural revolution in Britain, and later the industrial revolution there, and then that spread throughout the world in various stages, depending on what the European colonists brought to, say, India or other countries.
What do you think Quigley would make of the world today?
I think he'd be appalled. I'm rereading his book, Tragedy and Hope. I'd taken the course and dropped out of it, because the book and the class made no sense to me. And oddly enough, Quigley, who was a holy terror in class, was very pleasant, very conciliatory, and was concerned if I had enough credits to graduate, if I dropped his course, and so on. He was entirely 180 degrees from his public persona in the classroom. I am going through the book again after having given it away years ago. A journalist persuaded me to buy it. And I find it interesting. I find he's still using his stages of civilization. And I was reading at the end of the book just earlier today, and he seemed to have the idea that the future was open to question. He wasn't sure about the mutual assured destruction with nuclear weapons, and whether or not great powers like USSR and now Russia and the United States would be able to harness their conflicts and perhaps conflict in small marginal areas and on small marginal topics rather than risk major warfare, which I found interesting.
For those that have not come across Tragedy and Hope, we've talked about Evolution of Civilizations, and that's a pretty self-explanatory title, although you know, most people probably wouldn't have made many of the connections that he made in that other book. But what is the at the core of Tragedy and Hope? Why is it still, I mean, I know it's an enormously thick book, but it's still talked about almost in reverential terms.
Well, he has a lot of information packed into there, and he continues his concept of what makes a civilization, what causes a civilization to decline or to expand or to be resilient. And he makes a point many times throughout the book about how Western civilization is so resilient because it is not closed off. It is not restricted to one religion or one form of politics or one form of government. It includes monarchies like Britain and democracies, if you can still call the United States a democracy, like the United States. And he talks about the Middle East, and I didn't care for what I read about the Middle East today, where he's praising the apartheid entity of Israel and damning the Arabs for being essentially uncivilized warmongers who cannot cooperate one with another, even inside their own countries.
Yes, but it was written a long time ago, wasn't it? Was it?
Yeah, back in 1966, I think, when it was published.
Yeah, 1960s was very different. I mean, he's writing that before the Six-Day War, before the Yom Kippur War, before the October War. You know, that was a very big expansion of the territory of the Israeli state, and almost a turnaround, really, in sentiment towards Israel by many people around the world.
Exactly. But he makes a point of going through, I haven't gone through that part yet again, where he talks about the international banking system and who's behind it and who's driving it and so forth. And the book
That's key. That's key, yeah. Isn't it, nowadays? Yes. It's critical. The financial system, it seems to me, what we've gone from is we've gone from a whole kind of nation state, individual central banking system, and slowly but surely the enormous private banks like HSBC, Deutsche Bank, etc., you know the ones I mean, these have become much more dominant. The Bundesbank, the old national banks have become kind of supine, really. So you've got effectively a kind of international banking system. Is this something that Quigley predicted?
Yes, he did. He had sections in the book on the banking system and the relation of the banking system to warfare and civilization and the development of Europe and the United States, and how countries that were still developing had to borrow money to finance their railroads and sanitation and agriculture and things like this.
We at the moment in the UK, we've got a dispute in Oxford University about the statue of Cecil Rhodes. I know he features pretty heavily in Tragedy and Hope, and Quigley believed that he was instrumental in creating these very powerful lobby groups now, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House in London, which you hear all the time on the BBC. In fact, when I worked there, I was told by my producer, "Oh, just get somebody from Chatham House," so they're very much in the forefront of forming opinion and the narrative of where we're going, how we understand the world around us, and of course organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States are kind of equivalent private lobby for foreign policy. Now, What do you make of the dispute about Rhodes? Was he a villain or a hero or somewhere in between?
I'd probably say somewhere in between. He certainly did a fantastic job of colonizing East Africa. And, of course, he used his money that he made from this to found Rhodes Scholarships to bring people to Britain for education and to improve their outlook and to make sure that they were well connected to the ruling class and the ruling parts of society. Quigley, I think, from what I've read, seemed to have the idea that he liked the idea of a kind of a hidden hand, where you had groups of people that were, if not perhaps terribly secret societies, stayed out of the limelight and did their manipulating from afar, and based it on education and money and wealth and loans and things like this.
Well, yeah, but Rhodes was alive at the end of the 18th century, and he died, I think, pretty much at the turn of the century, around about 1900. He had in his mind this idea that the British Empire, at that stage, of course, it was near its height in terms of its reach around the world. You know, the sun never setting, etc. That the British Empire could and should take over the world.
Yeah, I think Quigley liked that idea. He sort of thought that the British were a civilizing influence. Whether or not this is accepted by, say, the Indians, on the other hand, I don't know.
Well, of course, they didn't accept that. And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, as a civilizing influence, I think there's a lot of questions now about, particularly about the Anglo-American, the NATO countries, as to whether they're even vaguely interested in civilizing countries. It seems to me as if things maybe have just turned on their head. Wherever there's somewhere that the Americans and the British seem to get involved, everything turns to rubble rather quickly and the infrastructure gets destroyed. I'm thinking here about, you know, Iraq, about Syria, and particularly Libya.
Oh, exactly right. The NATO and the Anglo-American influence has seemed to turn into an aggressive, aggrandizing, not so much a neocolonial power, but a warmongering organization whose original concept was self-defense from the wicked Soviet bloc. And with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, about the time before the Soviet Union went down, NATO is now expanded to practically the Russian frontier and is operating in South and Southwest Asia and in the Balkans and North Africa. And that is hardly a peaceful attitude to have. I mean, NATO has no right to exist, period.
Well, look, the big question here is, where did it all go so wrong? Because Rhodes left his money in his wills to create these various roundtable groups, the CFR in the US, the Chatham House in London, various other similar organizations have sprung up, these private lobbies for politics and foreign policy. And something went wrong, didn't it? Somewhere along the line, that potential power that could civilize and extend its reach right around the world, even possibly become a kind of world government, turned nasty. It seems that where it didn't get its way, it would rather, it's almost like ruin a country rather than allow it to go to a competing superpower like the Chinese or the Russians.
Well, I think, at least as far as the United States goes, the whole problem went from bad to worse about the time the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The United States needs enemies to justify its vast expenditures on the armed forces and military equipment and the intelligence services. And the businessmen and the politicians were so clever in getting together that you have defense plants in virtually every state of the Union and in, if not the majority, then a good number of congressional districts. So they want to bring the pork home. They want to bring the jobs home. They want to bring the factories home that employ all their constituents. And what better way to employ them is to have enemies everywhere with the Soviets no longer there. And the country in dire shape internally, you had to find terrorists, you had to find Islamists, you had to find a resurgent Russia. So I think that this is continuing to the point where people still can't believe anything bad about the United States. I was talking about my book Visas for Al-Qaeda to a woman who was a student at American University at the gym. And she was graduating and wanted to work for the State Department. And I had handed her a brochure for the book and told her about what the United States had been doing to the rest of the world. And she says, I can't believe that. The United States wouldn't do that. The United States is a great and good country. And I talked to a German official in a company that translated the book into German. And he had talked to his sister, who was a medical doctor. And he was telling her about the book and how I had lined out what the United States had done to bring down the world. And she said, no, the United States can't do that. I believe in the United States. The United States saved us after the end of the war. And he said, well, she's intelligent. She's a medical doctor. She has friends. She goes out into the world. Yet she doesn't see reality in front of her face.
Gosh, this is worrying, isn't it? I wonder if Rhodes would be turning in his grave if he could see the way things have gone. It's like this grand project has kind of hit the buffers or somehow turned rotten.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that you might be able to make comments about Rhodes or someone else. You know, no one is pure as a driven snow. in another century, different attitudes. At one point, slavery was good, and it was beneficial, and so on and so forth. And now, my God, if you say that Robert E. Lee was a great general, you're a horrible racist hate monger. So it people don't seem to realize that thoughts and change over the years, and what is wonderful one year and in one century may be absolutely horrible seen in another century.
So, well, I mean, we here in Bristol, we're in the center of this row about Edward Colston and the slave trade. We've also had similar questions in the United States, in I think it's Charlottesville, about the statue of Albert Pike, who was a Confederate soldier officer. And obviously Rhodes, we're talking about in Oxford. Where do you draw the line? Do you think that it's these people from the past, even if it does turn out that they've done absolutely terrible, disgusting things, should there ever be questions about whether there should be statues of them in Main Street and on the Central Square in Bristol, for example?
Well, I think that's erasing history. At least as far as the Americans go, history is something that happens somewhere else, not here. You've got to realize that people were great generals who fought classic battles that are still taught in military academies today. People who might have been slave traders at one point also did a lot to expand world trade, who brought prosperity to their people. If you want to be really hard-nosed about it, you can simply put up a plaque saying this was him then, and this is what we think now.
There's been some sort of talk about doing something like, but the other thing is, people have pointed out here that you know, these individuals with all their wealth so obtained through slavery, etc., would do things like set up schools that could continue to teach for hundreds of years into the future what wonderful people they'd been.
Yeah, exactly. And they did create schools and did grant large sums of money for the betterment of mankind. But somehow this goes out the window when you say, oh, they were slave traders, or they were Confederate generals, or whatever.
And what about this whole idea of the scholars? Because that is potentially a great thing, that somebody should get basically a prime minister's education at university, you know, as being taught by somebody like Carol Quigley, or someone that goes to Rhodes House in Oxford, getting a fantastic education about how things really work. I mean, you can't help but thinking it would be better, really, if everybody had access to that, rather than just a chosen few who have been tapped up especially for it, aged 16 or 18.
Well, exactly right. As far as this idea of education goes, at least in the United States, nobody can afford to go to university anymore. The prices around Washington, D.C. are $50,000 a year. And who has $200,000 to pay to a university? Even if you do get student aid, if you do have a work-study program, you're restricting and cutting back the number of people who would benefit from a college education.
But my question is really about, you know, how it is decided who is going to do that, who is going to get these jobs. Now, that, you know, is open to abuse, isn't it? Yeah. So, for example, here in Bristol, we've got our mayor, Marvin Rees. He went to become a Yale World Fellow, and he's done various of these courses. He was tapped up at 16, 18 to do that. He got himself a nice job at the BBC. It's almost like a kind of conveyor belt to power that bears no relation to your actual merit at the as your ability.
Exactly right. And that is a crime, and that is something that needs to be looked at intensely.
Okay, so just to sum up, maybe you could just tell us, you know, one of your favourite moments with Carol Quigley, and give us an idea of, you know, what he was like and how it really made an impression on you, something which has stayed with you all this time.
Well, I think what impressed me the most, I guess two things. One, when I was dropping his World Since 1914 course, and he was so concerned about whether I had enough credits to graduate. He was very kindly, very concerned about me personally. Whereas in class, he was a holy terror and lambasted the students and was extremely dictatorial. And I think another thing that I liked about him in the Development of Civilizations course was he tried to teach you to think, where he had these development of civilization stages where you had to look at what was influencing a civilization in a given period and whether that would be good or bad for the continuance of the civilization. He taught you to look at the entire world and see it as a whole, not just American history in a certain period, not European history in a certain period, but world history from earliest times, from the Sumerians and Babylonians, all through the Middle East and through the present. So it was something that made you see things as a whole, not as individual discrete parts.
Yeah, because that's one of the most difficult jobs of any lecturer or teacher, is to how to teach someone to think. How do you do that rather than just teach them to repeat what you're telling them?
Exactly right. You know, you put out something that shows change and what brought about change, and you ask questions. Well, what do you think about this? How would you have done it? How would you have modified it? What is your analysis of this? He probably had the only course at Georgetown where the professor really required you to think.
Sounds like a great teacher. Anyway, couldn't you just tell us a bit finally about your book? Just remind us what that is called and how to get hold of it.
Sure. I actually have two books. The first book was Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. It talks about my entrance into the State Department and how I was forced to issue visas to terrorists. And it develops this thesis of the concept of the cadre of Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever, essentially it's brand name changing more than anything else. And it's available through Amazon. You can get it at amazon.co.uk. The second book is about the migrants that are flooding Europe and flooding Britain, from what I can see in the news articles. And it basically talks about how the American wars in the Middle East are driving these people out from destroyed countries and destroyed infrastructure, and carefully guided into Europe by the American intelligence services and others to ensure that Europe will remain weak, will not become a competitor to the United States, and how they're hoping to split the Germans with their education and with their technology away from the Russians with their vast resources and their education and their technology. And that's also available from Amazon, .co.uk. That's been translated into Spanish and German. And the first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, has been translated into German.
Ultimately, though, where are we heading with all this?
I've got to say downhill. There's a marvelous book that's been out for years by Morris Berman called Dark Ages America, that talks about the things we've been mentioning in this talk today, and mentions the fact that the United States might flatten the downward spiral from time to time, but it's not going to be able to pull out no matter what politicians you have in office, because the basic economy, the basic educational structure, the lack of any kind of cohesive society anymore is just falling apart.
Yeah, but you've got to have some light at the end of the tunnel, Mike, please, because, you know, even if there is a collapse, that doesn't mean to say that's the end, does it?
No. Quigley's viewpoint was that Western civilization was sufficiently robust and inclusive that it has existed for some 1,500 years and may well go on further if it doesn't become a hidebound, ossified, and restrictive and exclusionary.
Yeah, but that it seems to be heading that way, doesn't it?
Regrettably, yes. And the question is, will there be a new outside influence that will revive the Western civilization, or will it go the way of other civilizations that Western civilization have pushed out of reality into the past, like Latin America and the Middle East and Asia?
I mean, I can't help but thinking of Russia. Russia was in a bit of a dark age during the Soviet time. They seem to be very positive. If you go to Moscow, Moscow is a place where the young people just see a very bright future over there. And I wonder if there might be some of that influence leaching into Europe. I mean, we've seen so much of from the United States and from Britain and other European countries against the Russians over the years. I wonder if it's the Russians that they fear the most, because the Russians have actually managed to get on top of at least having some form of free society where people can kind of get on and do their own thing, even if they are kind of hidebound by a mafia. That mafia doesn't control the Kremlin.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's one of the things that Quigley mentions in his books, Development of Civilization and Tragedy and Hope, that the periphery, like in the case of Russia, has influences on the center of Western civilization and may have a chance of revivifying it.
Well, let's hope so. Mike Springman, thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners.